When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
You're listening to part 2 of Unexplained Season 4, Episode 11, New Dawn Fades. Down at the officers' club on Roswell Army Airfield, 40-year-old Major Jesse Marcel had just settled in to eat lunch when an unusual call came in from the Chavez County Sheriff's Department. Taking it in his office, he listened carefully as the man on the other end of the line, Sheriff George Wilcox, proceeded to relay what he himself had just been told by local rancher Mac Brazel, that something appeared to have broken up over a section of ranch land that he managed, and that he had no idea what it was. "That's all very well, Sheriff," said Marcel, a little confused, "but what's it got to do with us?" "Well," said Wilcox, pausing for a moment, "he thinks it might have something to do with those flying discs we've all been hearing about." In July 1947, Major Jesse Marcel was the base intelligence officer of the 509th Bombardment Group. Prior to this, he worked for Shell Oil as a specialist in constructing maps from aerial photography, before volunteering for the US Air Force shortly after the outbreak of the Second World War. After excelling in intelligence officer training, in 1943, Marcel was dispatched to the South Pacific as a squadron intelligence officer for US Air Force 5th Bomber Command, where he remained until the end of the war. Marcel's service earned him a number of medals, as well as the Bronze Star, and eventually a promotion to Major. Well respected by his colleagues, Marcel had little interest in science fiction or speculation about little green people. However, there was good reason to be concerned about just what exactly had come down on the ranch. Ever since Kenneth Arnold's apparent strange sightings the previous month, the US military had been on high alert for unidentified flying objects, the emphasis being on unidentified. It's a common misconception that the term UFO, which wouldn't be coined until 1953, refers exclusively to objects of extraterrestrial origin, when in fact it refers merely to any object in the sky that has yet to be identified. Back in 1947, military personnel tended to label such things as simply bogies, a catch-all term for anything appearing unexpectedly on radar that had the potential to be hostile. And what concerned the US military in 1947, far more than the possibility of interplanetary attack, was a somewhat earthlier fear of the unknown. More specifically, the unknown capabilities of the Soviet Union's military. a fear heightened by paranoia at what secrets they might have unearthed, having acquired a number of Germany's leading scientists at the end of the war. After all, it was only recently that the US government learned of the German Army's V-2 rocket program, not to mention that the US government themselves maintained a number of secretive programs of modern weapons development. It was only reasonable to speculate, therefore, that all these reports of flying saucers could have something to do with new Soviet technology. It was late in the afternoon of Monday, July 7th, that Major Marcel jumped into an army jeep and sped off toward the Foster Ranch, accompanied by counterintelligence officer Sheridan Cavett. Pulling up to the ranch house a few hours later, with the sun already dipping below the horizon, they were greeted by Mac Brazel. Mac wasted no time in showing them the scraps of material he had taken back to the ranch. Though they were certainly unusual, thought Marcel, he was keen to see the rest of the debris to get a bigger picture. However, with the light fading fast, there was little point in heading out there that evening, and so the three of them bedded down for the night and waited for morning. Shortly after 5 a.m. the following day, Marcel and Cavett awoke to the cool pink haze of a New Mexico sunrise. Gathering their things, they jumped back into the jeep and, along with Brazel, drove out into the desert. After 20 minutes cruising through the scrub, Brazel instructed them to stop. "There," he said, pointing to the bush where he'd attempted to gather the rest of the broken pieces. Cavett turned off the engine, and together the three of them jumped out and headed on toward the debris.
Headline edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army. As a matter of fact, the 509th Atomic Bomb Group headquarters at Roswell, New Mexico, reports that it has received one of the discs, which landed on a ranch outside Roswell. The disc landed at a ranch at Corona, New Mexico, and the rancher turned it over to the Air Force. Rancher W.W. Brazel was the man who discovered the saucer. Colonel William Blanchard of the Roswell Air Base refuses to give details of what the flying disc looks like.
The press release had been ordered by Colonel Blanchard soon after Marcel briefed him on what they had discovered at the ranch. The excited radio broadcasts would continue thick and fast throughout the day, and the afternoon's newspapers would soon follow suit, as all over the world the public began to hear about the extraordinary news. The 8th of July edition of the Roswell Daily Record led with "Roswell Army Airfield Captures Flying Saucer on Ranch in Roswell." As the article went on to state, according to information released by the intelligence office of the 509th, the disc was recovered on a ranch in the Roswell vicinity after an unidentified rancher had notified Sheriff George Wilcox here that he'd found the instrument on his premises. Major Marcel and a detail from his department went to the ranch and recovered the disc. The intelligence office stated that no details of the saucer's construction or its appearance had been revealed. Having delivered a significant amount of the debris from the ranch back to Roswell Airfield, Major Marcel was then ordered to ship out with it immediately to the Air Force base at Fort Worth in Texas. From there, it would be reviewed by more senior personnel before they decided what to do with it next. And so it was that only a few hours later, Major Marcel touched down in Texas. At the offices of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, just 6 miles east of the Army airfield, editor Callum Green listened with astonishment as the radio reports came in about the flying saucer's discovery. A short time later, he received the once-in-a-lifetime tip-off that the wreckage of the apparent flying disc was heading to Fort Worth. Seeing 20-year-old military editor and photographer John Bond Johnson at his desk, Green hurried over to him. "You're going to want to take your camera for this one," he said, with a smile. Within minutes, Johnson was at the wheel of his Ford Club coupe, speeding off toward the Army airfield. Johnson had been a police reporter for the Telegram since 1943, but by 47, he was also a pilot officer in the Civil Air Patrol, having joined the Army Air Force as a trainee during the war, a fact that Green hoped might help him gain access to the base. Excited by the prospect of his first solo assignment, all Johnson could think about was getting there in time to publish the story for that night's edition. Arriving in double quick time, he was relieved to find he was the first one there. After announcing himself at the front gate, he was swiftly ushered through and told to head directly for the office of Brigadier General Roger Ramey. Arriving outside his room, the first thing that struck Johnson was the intense, acrid burning odour coming from inside it. It reminded him of the burned-out buildings he encountered back when he was a police reporter. Knocking on the door, he was then invited in by Colonel Thomas Dubose, who informed him that Ramey would be joining them shortly. Inside, he saw on the floor in front of him a jumble of broken rods and ripped sheets of what appeared to be some kind of foil. These bits and pieces, he assumed, were remnants of the apparent flying saucer, or at least some of it. Realizing he only had a few minutes to set up the camera and get the shots, Johnson attempted to make the pieces more presentable, but none of it seemed to fit together in any logical way. Moments later, Brigadier General Ramey appeared, along with Major Jesse Marcel, who seemed oddly reserved. Johnson then asked Ramey if they'd determined what it was exactly, but Ramey had no idea. And so, without wanting to waste any more time, Johnson had Ramey, Dubose, and Major Marcel pose for a few photographs alongside the debris. Having taken 6 photos in total, Johnson was thanked for his time, and with scoop in hand, he headed straight back to the Star Telegram to develop the pictures. An hour later, he handed the finished prints to his editor and headed home. Later that afternoon, as Johnson was driving home, back at the Fort Worth Air Force Base, another press release was being hastily arranged. Something, it seemed, had shifted in the narrative. At some time around 3 p.m, Brigadier General Ramey is thought by some to have received a call from his superior, General McMullen, instructing him to put out a new release.
General Ramey describes the object as being of flimsy construction, almost like a box type. He says that it was so battered that he was unable to determine whether it had a disc form, and he does not indicate its size. Ramey says that so far as can be determined, no one saw the object in the air, and he describes it as being made of some sort of tinfoil. Other Army officials say that further information indicates that the object had a diameter of about 20 to 25 feet, and that nothing in the apparent construction indicated any capacity for speed, and that there was no evidence of a power plant. But this also appeared too flimsy to carry a man. Now, back to Taylor Grant in New York.
By the following morning, the apparent flying saucer discovery had been nixed entirely. Or as the July 9th edition of the Roswell Daily Record declared, General Ramey empties Roswell saucer. The article continued, "An examination by the Army revealed last night that mysterious objects found on a lonely New Mexico ranch was a harmless, high-altitude weather balloon, and not a grounded flying disc." Excitement was high until Brigadier General Roger Ramey, commander of the 8th Air Forces with headquarters here, cleared up the mystery. Describing the materials as being nothing more than a bundle of tin foil, broken wood beams, and rubber remnants of a balloon, the general said the objects were the crushed remains of a ray wind target used to determine the direction and velocity of winds at high altitudes. A number of other papers followed suit, with many carrying the pictures that Johnson had taken of the material in Ramey's office. Most meteorologists, on examining the pictures, agreed that the supposed crash debris was indeed pieces of a weather balloon. However, there was one additional photo, now circulating in the press, which hadn't been taken by Johnson or any other known press photographer. The picture showed warrant officer and Army weather forecaster Irving Newton, who had not been present for Johnson's original photo session. Newton was put forward as an expert by the Army Air Force, confirming the weather balloon interpretation. The materials were eventually flown on to the Army's scientific and technical labs at Wright Field Base in Ohio, where the weather balloon explanation was again officially confirmed. Are you always taking care of your family? Do you often take care of others and not yourself? Now it's time to take care of yourself, to make time for you. You deserve it. Teladoc gives you access to a licensed therapist to help you get back to feeling your best, to feeling like yourself again. With Teladoc, you can speak to a licensed therapist by phone or video. Therapy appointments are available 7 days a week from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. local time. If you feel overwhelmed sometimes, maybe you feel stressed or anxious, depressed or lonely, or you might be struggling with a personal or family issue, Teladoc can help. Teladoc is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy to change counselors if needed, for free. Teladoc therapy is available through most insurance or employers. Download the app or visit teladoc.com/unexplainedpodcast today to get started. That's teladoc.com/unexplainedpodcast. The same day that people were waking up to the news that the apparent flying saucer was nothing but a weather balloon, the full account of Mac Brazel's story was also published in the Roswell Daily Record. Brazel's description of the debris was markedly underwhelming and clashed significantly with all original reports of a flying disc. When the debris was gathered up, he stated, the tinfoil, paper, tape, and sticks made a bundle about 18 or 20 inches long and about 5 inches thick. The article continued, in all, he estimated the entire lot would have weighed maybe 5 pounds. There was no sign of any metal in the area, which might have been used for an engine, and no sign of any propellers of any kind. There were no words to be found anywhere on the instrument, although there were letters on some of the parts. Considerable Scotch tape and some tape with flowers printed upon it had been used in the construction. No strings or wire were found either, but there were some eyelets in the paper to indicate that some sort of attachment may have been used. All of which was in keeping with the Army Air Force's explanation that it was merely a weather balloon that had broken up. Tantalizingly, however, Brazel, who had seen a number of such devices on the ranch before, concluded by stating that, whatever it was he had found, he was certain it was not a weather balloon. Either way, within days, the whole Roswell furore had all but completely blown over. Though an inordinate amount of discs were apparently spotted flying in the skies throughout the rest of the year, for the more skeptical of the public, the story was completely dead. For a start, with the Cold War heating up, there were far more pressing concerns than little green people. And even for the most ardent of UFO believers, this intriguing event soon vanished almost completely from public consciousness. But not everyone had forgotten about it. Unlike the majority of the public, far from ignoring the UFO flap of 1947, the US Army Air Force began to secretly investigate it. As mentioned earlier, this is unsurprising considering the heightened fear of possible attack to the nation at the time. Either way, the reports make for some interesting reading. As one official document is said to have noted, dated July 30, 1947, from a detailed study of reports, selected for their impression of veracity and reliability, several conclusions have been formed. The flying saucer situation is not at all imaginary or the result of seeing too much in some natural phenomena. Something is really flying around. On 28th of October 1947, General George Shulgin, chief of the U.S. Air Force Air Intelligence Requirements Division, issued a secret memo outlining the commonly reported features of what he termed the flying saucer-type aircraft, and instructed all military personnel to be on the lookout for such a device. Contrary to the opinions of some, however, the original memo did not include the statement that some elements in the military believed these objects represented interplanetary craft. Nonetheless, the United States Air Force continued to monitor and assess all UFO sightings for at least the next 20 years. This began with Project Sign, which was then superseded by Project Grudge, which eventually, in turn, became the more well-known Project Blue Book. In 1950, former Marine Corps naval aviator Donald Kehoe gave an interview in the US's True magazine, claiming to know for a fact that the Earth had been under close-range examination by living intelligent observers from another planet. The US Air Force responded with a 600-page report detailing and explaining away 237 apparent UFO cases. And so the dance would continue between believers and the military. Project Blue Book was formally shut down in 1969, though many, of course, believe the US government merely continued their efforts elsewhere. It may be surprising to learn, however, considering its notoriety today, the Roswell UFO incident had barely been mentioned since. But all that was about to change. At the turn of the 1970s, nuclear physicist Stanton Friedman had forged a reputation as one of the leading experts in his field, working for the likes of General Electric and Aerojet, amongst many others. Stanton's specialty was finding ways to incorporate nuclear technology as a power source for planes, rockets, and even space travel. By 1970, however, Friedman had given it all up to investigate the possible existence of intelligent alien life. His fascination in the subject had begun in 1958 after coming across a report on unidentified flying objects written by former Air Force officer and creator of the term UFO, Edward Ruppelt. As his own interest in the utility of nuclear power expanded, Friedman became intrigued by the prospect that beings from another planet were using it to visit Earth. In February 1978, Friedman was in a TV studio in Louisiana, preparing for an interview to promote a talk he was giving on UFOs later that night. During a quick coffee break, he got talking to the show's director, who suggested he get in touch with a friend of theirs that lived nearby, who claimed that they had not only seen a UFO, but had also touched it. By then, Friedman was something of a ufology celebrity, and this sort of interaction was par for the course. Nodding along politely, he thanked the director for the suggestion and made a mental note to add the name to the vast list of other individuals who'd contacted him claiming the same. Friedman hadn't given the name much thought, but with some time to kill at the local airport the next day, he made a quick call to information and asked them for a number for a man named Jesse Marcel. Dialing his number moments later, Friedman waited patiently until finally an elderly-sounding man picked up the phone. Friedman introduced himself, and the man in turn confirmed that he was indeed Jesse Marcel, formerly Major Marcel of the 509th Bombardment Group. The story of the Roswell incident would never be the same again. According to Friedman, for whatever reason, when Marcel answered the call that day, he decided to come clean about what really happened back in the summer of 1947. As he went on to explain, firstly, when he arrived at the location of what he referred to as the crash site, he didn't find the remaining pieces all neatly bundled up and stashed under a bush, or that all the pieces had already been picked up by Mac Brazel, as some reports claimed. But instead, he found a vast array of it was still there, covering an area of roughly 3/4 of a mile long and several hundred yards wide. More importantly, he claimed, the materials were like nothing he had ever encountered before. Some of it he described as being as thin as the foil from a cigarette packet, but extremely strong and impossible to break or tear. Other bits looked like thin beams of wood, but were in fact inordinately strong and had strange markings on them. When he later escorted the pieces of the wreckage to Fort Worth, Marcel claimed that only a small portion of them were taken out to show the press, while the rest of it was flown on to Wright Field in Ohio. He also claimed that he was given strict instructions to stay silent throughout the process. And slowly, more and more alternative versions of the story began to emerge. In 1979, an associate of Friedman's was told by Marcel's son, a medical doctor and, ironically, an aircraft accident investigator in his own right, that his father had actually brought some of the wreckage home. Though only 11 at the time, Dr. Jesse Jr. Marcel claimed to distinctly remember seeing a series of characters from an unknown language imprinted along the edges of some of the beams. The images, he said, reminded him of hieroglyphics. Friedman published these claims soon after, becoming known as the first civilian to investigate the apparent UFO crash near Roswell. But these revelations seemed only to be at the tip of an iceberg. Before long, more witnesses came forward, claiming secret knowledge of the events, that it wasn't only a spacecraft that was recovered, but bodies too, one of them possibly even alive. Dates were questioned as to when exactly it all occurred. Stories and interviews given at the time were scrutinized and re-evaluated for any sign of coercion or a wider plot to keep a lid on the real truth. Each interested party invariably finding in the evidence whatever they wanted to find. The rumors eventually escalating to incorporate that most secretive of US Air Force sites, Area 51, the place where some claim today the Roswell craft and its occupants was eventually taken and reverse engineered for its secrets. In 1994, the US Air Force, spurred on by the disproportionate attention that seemed to be directed at what they considered to be such an innocuous event, released its own findings into the Roswell incident. Incredibly, the Roswell report, Fact versus Fiction in the New Mexico Desert, concluded that there had been a cover-up, and that the weather balloon story had indeed been entirely manufactured to hide the truth. However, it wasn't due to any alien technology the Air Force had found, but rather to keep secret the existence of its own. It wasn't the innocuous weather balloon they first claimed, but rather a device that was being used as part of a secret operation known as Project Mogul. The project's purpose was to keep track of any atomic tests that the Soviet Union might be conducting. They did this by flying microphones at high altitudes to pick up on signature sound waves that such tests would give off. For the true believers, however, this was just yet another smokescreen, and the real truth, as they say, is still out there. If you enjoy listening to Unexplained and would like to help support us, you can now go to unexplainedpodcast.com/support. All donations, no matter how large or small, are massively appreciated. All elements of Unexplained are produced by me, Richard McLean Smith. Please subscribe and rate the show on iTunes, and feel free to get in touch with any thoughts or ideas regarding the stories you've heard on the show. Perhaps you have an explanation of your own you'd like to share. You can reach us online at unexplainedpodcast.com or Twitter at unexplainedpod and Facebook at facebook.com/unexplained. Now it's time to take care of yourself, to make time for you. Teladoc gives you access to a licensed therapist to help you get back to feeling your best. Speak to a licensed therapist by phone or video anytime between 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. local time, 7 days a week. Teladoc Therapy is available through most insurance or employers. Download the app or visit teladoc.com/unexplained podcast today to get started. That's teladoc.com/unexplained podcast.
Your new home journey starts at Fisher Homes, where everything is red, white, and new. Explore exclusive summer savings and start your journey by selecting your ideal home site and your dream community. Choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans and bring your style to life at the Lifestyle Design Center. Are you looking for a quick move-in ready home instead? Fisher Homes has options for those too. Fill out a form to connect with a new home advisor at fisherhomes.com to get started today before the sun sets on summer savings.
You wouldn't expect to hear that we're America's third best city for beer like this one. Or home to vibes like this. And this. It might surprise you that we're top 10 for immersive art that's like,
whoa.
And?
Hmm.
Not to mention, we have one of the top zoos in the country. So can a city with the country's best pro soccer team, ranking as a top culinary destination in the world, be in your own backyard? Yes, Columbus. Plan your summer at experiencecolumbus.com/summer.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.